Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the show, a leader in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints says gender is assigned at birth, angering LGBTQ Mormons. The National Park Service okays ATVs for use inside of national parks. And a West Valley City woman fights a lewdness charge for going topless in her own home. Joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune Managing Editor David Noyce. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning.
Also joining us is reporter Jessica Miller. And good morning and welcome to you, Jessica.
Good morning.
And George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist. Welcome to you, George.
Good morning.
Listeners, you can join this conversation with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. David Noyce, I want to cover some stories that that both appeared this week in the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune, and they both had to do with gender identity and sexual orientation. Let's start with a more recent story. A higher up in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Dallin Oaks, he made some comments on this subject. What exactly did he say, and in what venue?
Okay, Dallin Oaks is high up. He's second in command, as a matter of fact. He's Church President Russell M. Nelson's first counselor and next in line to be the next president of the church. He was speaking at general conferences this weekend. So the general officers of the church come in for a couple of days of training with the higher-ups in the church. And he was speaking to them on Thursday? Yes, Thursday. And, no, Wednesday. Wednesday. He spoke about love and the love of the Lord and the law, something that he actually did at his very first news conference when he was introduced with President Nelson in the new first presidency. And he talked about transgender issues, which is a subject 4 years ago when he appeared on a Tribune podcast with our editor Jennifer Napier Pierce. He had said that he was asked about transgender issues then, along with another apostle, and he said, we haven't really given that a lot of a thought.
Right.
And he obviously has been giving a lot of thought to it since then, because this is about the third or fourth speech he's given on it. But this one went further than others. He basically said that gender is eternal, and that the biological sex you're born with, a person is born with at birth, is your gender and has been your eternal gender. Mm-hmm. And that was new territory. A little bit for a lot of members, especially members LGBTQ members who have a stake in that language that might come.
Meaning, and so the implication is that if you are born a male, the church defines your gender as male,
and it always has been in his view at least. He pointed to a document called the Family Proclamation,
right,
which is quoted a lot in Mormonism. It was something that was introduced in 1995 by President Hinckley during President Hinckley's time. And it kind of spells out Mormon beliefs in the family. A lot of traditional kind of concepts are in it, but some other things. And one of the lines is essentially saying that gender is eternal. It always has been. That a person's gender has always been around. A lot of transgender members and LGBTQ members and others have looked at that document and says, well, yeah, I agree with that. But my sex that was assigned to birth was wrong. I do believe, like we interviewed Lori Lee Hall, a transgender woman who was a church architect, actually designed temples, was a stake president, decided that she had, we didn't decide, she knew that she had always been a female. So she started identifying that way, and she ended up being excommunicated. But she would look at that language in the Family Proclamation and say, yeah, I agree with that language. That language is okay.
It was vague enough before being maybe clarified this week by Dallin Oaks to say, for her to say to herself, look, my eternal identity is female, yeah, even though I was born male.
Exactly. So it was exactly vague enough, or at least broad enough, that people could carve that into it. And Dallin Oaks said that, well, of course, that's not what we meant when we did it. We meant this, and that's what it is. However, he did say, Leaders have the right to clarify and to expand on things, and I'm going to do that right now.
Is his word the final word on this? Meaning, does he, now that he's said it and given his position in the church, is it sort of rule, law, canonical, however you want to say it?
I'd be surprised if anyone while Dallin Oaks is around in the position he's in would buck that, among higher-ups, I mean. But of course, Mormons believe in something called continuous revelation, which gives them continuous wiggle room, of course, to change and adapt and adopt different policies. But he definitely did sort of draw a line in the sand on it, at least in a lot of people's view. Another interesting thing is he said in the same speech that, and we obviously did not hear it, it was a closed session, so we're just going by information that the church provided of what was spoken. He did say that, well, we don't understand why people are born with same-sex attraction or gender or sexual identity confusion. This is what should happen or how it should be treated in the church. So, yeah.
Does it matter that these statements from Dallin Oaks are coming just before the General Conference? Does it give them more substance, more weight?
Well, I don't know that it gives it more substance, more weight in the long run, although in the short run, anything that's said during General Conference time, and in this case to the general officers of the church, I think a lot of people view as authoritative, maybe more authoritative certainly than a speech that you might give at a stake center someplace.
So you said, you know, you sought reactions from some people in the transgender community, among them Lori Lee Hall, who is this architect that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. How has the broader community responded to these statements?
Disappointed, very disappointed, and very trying to understand, still grapple, maybe still trying to look for language that even in what Dallin Oaks said that they can feel comfortable with. It's no doubt causing a lot of pain. It was a kind of a weird day in the fact that the church also announced that day, Russell Nelson announced that they were going to allow women to take part in some ceremonies concerning official witnessing of baptisms and temple sealings or marriages in the temple, which they hadn't been able to do for years. So that was sort of seen as a big step forward on gender equality, and then Dallin Oaks gives this speech. So it's sort of almost like a good cop, bad cop thing, you know, I think a lot of people's view.
Well, there's this – I want to bring George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist, in on this. And George, the question here is that there have been big shifts in the church on specific items, you know, gender parity being kind of the latest big jump or attempts towards that, changes on race, changes on a lot of things. That had given people in the LGBTQ community hope that they might see something similar. And I don't know, maybe that's just further down the road. What do you see in this, George?
Well, like Dave says, there's the church prides itself, I think, on what it calls the continual revelation. And that's the kind of thing where if they change and you like the change and you say, yay, they're open-minded and they think and they're with the future. And if you don't like what they said, then it's just, oh, they're a bunch of old stick-in-the-muds. Or, you know, maybe they move forward and you don't like moving forward and they say, hey, wait a minute, you told us this for all these years and now you're telling us that. I'm getting the bends here. What am I supposed to do? But I mean, then it becomes the role of the church to kind of hold people's hand and move them through the change that the church has decided to take. I mean, it is almost like one step forward and two steps back, and it is almost kind of like maybe not getting into these people's true feelings, but a feeling of, well, we've moved on same sex and we've moved on non-discrimination and everything, and maybe that's all some of our members can handle. You know, so let's stick to a more old-fashioned view on this other thing, which hasn't, just in the general society, hasn't moved as far. It's much more interest and concern than it used to be. But, you know, speaking as somebody, one, as an opinion writer, so I can say anything I want, and two, somebody who was born down the road from Harry Truman and has never been a Mormon, just how many millennial members do they want to lose? And especially now, I mean, if they move forward on medical marijuana or same-sex marriage or something like that, then there's really kind of a, through most of the society, there's a little murmur. If they take what is perceived to be a step backwards or stand athwart history, then that gets a lot more attention, a lot more press, especially in the the Mormon community of people who maybe who aren't very active or people who aren't Mormon at all and don't quite understand anything about it except when there's this big splash in the media. And, you know, you're going to have more resignations out of this. You're going to have more people deciding, well, you know, I still sort of identify as a Mormon, but I'm not really too crazy about it as like I am, like maybe I was a year ago because I don't like what these people are saying.
Well, this is a question that I have that is probably unanswerable, but, you know, the opinions of people, the sort of general populace, you know, the lower downs in the church, not the higher ups, does that... you know, have an impact on the kinds of decisions that end up getting made that drive doctrine? I mean, that's seems like a really tough question.
Yeah. Doctrine, it depends on how you want to try the difference between doctrine and policy.
Sure.
And people parse that all the time, of course, including the leaders to parse that. I guess I could point to President Nelson's words himself last month when he was speaking at BYU.
Right.
And explained a little bit more about the LGBTQ exclusion policy that came in November 2015 and then was done away with like 3.5 years later or something like that.
And this is for the children of,
yes,
of LGBTQ.
Could not be baptized or join the church, yes. And he said at that time, we feel pain. When people are hurting, we feel it. We know that they're hurting, and we don't like that people are hurting. Now, he didn't apologize, and he didn't do any of those kinds of steps that I think a lot of people would like to see happen. But he did say, we feel this. They know when people are hurting, and so
of course,
I guess you could say that how could that not have an influence?
Well, in that same speech, though, he said, and I'm just going to quote here. This is actually Oakes in mm-hmm. drawing on the speech from President Russell M. Nelson. He said that the church reaffirmed the position that God decrees marriage can only be between a man and a woman, and that, quote, eternal life, the greatest gift of God to his children, is only possible through the creative powers inherent in the combination of male and female joined in an eternal marriage. Wow, that's hard to get out. George Pyle, actually, let's go back to Dave for a second, because Dave, there is a second, as I said, there's a second story here that kind of plays into this, which is the Tribune this past week also reported on a conference that occurred here in Salt Lake City having to do with this very topic, and it was by the group Mormons Building Bridges. What was their conference about?
Right, in concert with the Tanner Humanities Center at the U, they had a 2-day conference, and we did stories from both days of the conference. And I think the story that probably pertains to this was a speech by Taylor Petrie, who I think gave the McMurrin lecture Friday night on that. He talked about, and Taylor Petrie is a religion professor at Kalamazoo in college or university in Michigan. And he was just recently named the editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. It's a scholarly magazine for sort of Latter-day Saint intellectuals. And he gave a really actually deep dive into doctrine, LDS doctrine on sexuality and fluidity and sexuality and views. It's really brainy stuff. But he talked about how the church's position, just in its short lifespan, has evolved and changed, and sort of saw in that, and sort of conjectured that we may continue to see evolution. He talked about how the church had, and I won't go into all the details about, you know, he quoted ancient writings and things like that, and modern writings.
He also pointed to the family proclamation.
Family proclamation.
That we talked about earlier.
Exactly. Yes, which is sort of becoming a flashpoint for this discussion that's been going on. He talked about how the church had a sort of a patriarchal, he called, mythology. Mm. He used the word mythology just to describe a system of teachings. And then evolved to a heterosexual, what he called mythology. And he spells out the different reasons and how things could change. He pointed to biblical writings where New Testament says that people are neither male nor female, and he said maybe that's more literal, you know. Maybe they're not just male or female. Maybe there's some kind of interplay between. So it was interesting. Now, this was given before Dallin Oaks' speech.
Right.
So his speech might have been a little bit different, you know. I mean, not that he would change his view, but say this would certainly add a whole new chapter to his speech.
George Pyle, the title of this conference was A Spiritual Home, and it was focused on building bridges for sexual and gender minorities within the LDS Church. I'm just, as before we head to a break, Are those bridges, you know, given these comments, are they going away? Are they no longer there? Are they burned?
Yeah, well, they've got a little bit of a bridgehead here. And, yeah, every once in a while you cross a bridge and then you come to another bridge and it hasn't been burned down, but maybe it has, like, barbed wire in front of it or something. And so you have to keep going, as we say. I mean, this church is not the only church that does this, but it will leave itself some wiggle room. And that's kind of what churches are for, is to help their members negotiate the real world and the changes in the world. And sometimes you have the problem of, well, wait a minute, you told us this was eternal truth, and now you're telling us this is eternal truth. You know, make up your mind here. And if you're not going to know what the real eternal truth is, I'm not going to follow you anymore. That's for people who are interested in knowing a real eternal truth. Others who are comfortable with not knowing can probably better roll with it.
Okay. That's George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist, expressing his opinions here on Behind the Headlines. We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we will turn to some lewdness charges a Utah woman is challenging. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Managing Editor David Noyes, reporter Jessica Miller, and editorial page editor George Pyle. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you are invited to join us with your questions and comments. Again, you can call 801-355-8255, or you can tweet to us at KCPW is our handle. Jessica Miller, let's bring you into the conversation now. You covered a story about a woman in West Valley City who is facing charges for doing something in her home that most everyone does at some point or another. She had her shirt off. Who is this woman, and what is the actual charge she is facing? And then actually, where did that charge come from? Three questions.
So many questions. So the woman's name is Tilly Buchanan. She's a 27-year-old woman who lives in West Valley, and she was charged earlier this year with lewdness involving a child. Prosecutors say that she was topless in her home and in front of her three stepchildren, and so they've charged her with a crime that's a Class A misdemeanor. If she's convicted, she faces possible jail time and would have to register on the sex offender registry for 10 years.
And this is, okay, for being topless in front of children in her own home. Can you,
yes.
Can you describe the circumstances? I mean, how did investigators get wind of the fact that she was topless?
So, you know, like a lot of criminal cases, there's kind of like the two versions of what happened here. She told me that basically they were out in their garage, her and her husband, and they were doing some construction, and the materials they were using were kind of like itchy, like insulation type stuff. So when they come back into their home, they take their clothes off because they want to go take a shower. They're itchy and sweaty. And the kids kind of like bound down the stairs and see her topless. And she kind of, you know, the kids are kind of embarrassed. And so she thinks of this as an impromptu teaching moment. She tells the kids, you know, you're not embarrassed when you see your dad without his shirt on. You shouldn't be embarrassed with seeing me without my shirt on. This isn't a sexual thing. You know, if he can do it, so can I. The kids ended up telling their mom what had happened, and there was a very unrelated investigation involving DCFS with the kids. And so this situation became known to investigators through that kind of unrelated investigation. And the prosecutor's version of events is a little bit more...
Right. Can I
yes.
I just want to go through the details for a second. So the stepmom, you know, takes her shirt off. The kids see mm-hmm. it, tell their mom. The mom then goes to the police, and the police file charges against the stepmom.
Right. Yeah. Okay. The police were already involved in the family anyways for another situation.
Okay, got it.
But it came up as part of that. But that other situation had nothing to do with Tilly or things that were going on in their home. It was a different thing. But the authorities were already involved in that family dynamic.
Okay. And then as you were about to say that there were some details that are in dispute. dispute in this story.
Right. Yeah. The prosecutors say that that she stripped in front of the kids, and that she may have. They didn't say that she was drunk, but that maybe she had been drinking alcohol, and that she had said, you know, I'm not going to put my shirt back on to her husband. She said, I'm not putting my shirt back on unless you expose yourself to me or the kids or something. So it was a little bit very different version of events here. So the prosecutors are saying, you know, this was a crime that she exposed herself. The law says you have to show that that she did so with the intention of causing affront or alarm, and so that's kind of what they would have to prove in court.
So is the lewdness charge? I mean, I guess is the lewdness charge that she's facing for having her shirt off in her own home in front of her kids or in front of her stepkids?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So how is this going to play out? I mean, there's this argument in the or a ruling from the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals in Colorado that kind of plays into all of this. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's really interesting because Tenth Circuit Court ruling has been in the news very recently, but this was decided a while ago. This decision came out in February. It's a decision involving Fort Collins, Colorado, and some women had basically sued saying, you know, I should be, they were challenging that city's ordinance that said women can't be topless in public. And so they were, you know, saying that this is unconstitutional, this is unfair to women. And it went up to the Tenth Circuit Court, and in February they made their decision siding with the women. So women in Fort Collins now can be topless.
Does it just apply to Fort Collins?
That is a very good question, and it depends on who you ask. So after that decision, you know, Fort Collins had a certain amount of time where they could appeal. That appeals period had passed, but I think a reporter in Fort Collins must have asked the city, like, hey, do you plan to appeal? And they said no, and then it became this big thing. Everyone was saying, you can go topless in Utah now, but that's not actually true. I mean, it sets the precedent, right? The Tenth Circuit covers Utah, Colorado, other states. But in a case like Tilly's, you can use it to make an argument, which her defense attorney is doing, that, you know, the Tenth Circuit has ruled this and it applies in Utah. And that's what they're doing. So you can't just walk around topless yet. Women of Utah.
Yet. Yeah. Okay. But so, and this has to do with lewdness, Utah's lewdness statute, which is, I guess, sort of akin to the Fort Collins lewdness statute. Is that?
There's some similar. It depends on who you ask, right? Hmm. You ask the defense attorney, Tilly's attorney, and he says, oh, yeah, of course this is binding. The language is super similar. You know, it's basically saying the same thing. The prosecutors are saying, no, that was a city ordinance. This is a state statute, and then they make this argument that if we strip out any language in the law that differentiates male and female breasts, then it could have other effects on, say, charges, more serious charges, where it's illegal to touch an underage girl's breasts. If we strip that language out, would that allow, like, a coach to touch the breasts of an underage girl if we don't differentiate between male and female breasts?
Boy, I mean, it's a really interesting story, and part of it makes me think that what is lewd is kind of a matter of public opinion, and also how cultural norms have made us think this way. Mm-hmm. I think this is a George Pyle question. George, I mean, go ahead, jump in.
Well, okay, for one thing, I mean, all the comments, all the letters, all the instant reaction has been, don't the police have any real criminals to chase? Why are they doing this? And she's in her own home. It's not like she was walking down the street or in the park or something where, you know, people who wouldn't want to see this could barely avoid seeing it. That's a huge difference. Now, the real difference here, I would say, is there is a huge difference, I would think, before the law, between somebody who's standing in their own home naked and somebody comes upon them, and somebody who deliberately takes her clothes off in front of somebody, especially a child. And that's the two different versions of the story we have. And to pursue this, I mean, apparently the prosecutors are believing the more salacious version of the story, which, you know, you're in this custody thing and everything, and it just gets so complicated. My personal opinion is that the law should leave these people alone in their own home unless there's some real accusation of abuse, which in my mind, this doesn't reach. It is obviously going to be a factor if these parents are arguing about custody and the amount of time they spend here or there or things like that. But that's for the civil thing that's out of the public view. And I mean, personally, I do think especially the idea that she should have to register as a sex offender. I mean, even if she did what the prosecutors say she did, I think that's ridiculous.
If this case does, you know, I guess what I'm wondering is this case going to turn on the broader conversation of lewdness or on the fact that this did happen within the privacy of their own home? And in which case, it probably won't have any effect on state statute.
Right. So the next court hearing that's coming up is actually an oral argument, and the motion is to find the lewdness statute unconstitutional. So it is going to be a broader discussion first about whether, like, the statute, the law as it is written, does it discriminate against women? The underlying, like, what she did is not as important at this point. That's more things that would happen at a trial if the judge rules that the law is constitutional and the case just goes forward.
So we're just waiting for that to happen first, and then and so there's going to be a broad public discussion about whether or not, basically, you know, women's nipples versus men's nipples are prurient, and you know, I mean, we would be having an entirely different conversation, I think, if we were taught as children that, you know, one was one way and one was the other. This is just an overarching sort of broad statement that I'm making here, but I'm it'll be interesting to see what happens next. George Pyle, do you have any final comments before we move on to other stories?
No, I think I'm going to stay away from this. This is enough. I got some stories I'll tell you off air, but I don't
know.
That's great. Okay, Jessica, I want to turn, actually, let me remind listeners that they can join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can also tweet us at KCPW with your questions and comments. Jessica, I want to turn to another story, an entirely different story that you covered this past week, and it has to do with a relatively new Utah law allowing victims of certain crimes to ask for their cases to be reexamined in some instances. Mm-hmm. And it involves four Utah women who have hit various roadblocks in trying to get their sexual assault cases heard. The 2019 legislative session produced a new path for these women to pursue, and now that new path is hitting some snags in terms of how the law is actually being implemented. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So about a year ago, some attorneys, you know, with kind of like a victim's rights attorneys, kind of identified this issue where if a victim says, you know, I was sexually assaulted, all of the power on whether their case is taken to court or not relies just on their local prosecutor. And if that prosecutor decides, I mean, these are hard cases. A lot of them are, you know, he said, she said. The idea that sexual contact happened is not in dispute. It's a consent issue. And if the local prosecutor decides, you know, there wasn't enough evidence or it's not a good case and they decline to take it, then that's pretty much it. Like, that's where it stopped. You as a victim could not go appeal to anybody else or ask anybody else for a review. And so this new law, it created a process for victims of first-degree felonies. It's targeted towards sex assault victims. But anyone who has been a victim of a first-degree felony, if their local prosecutor declines their case, they can go to the attorney general's office and ask them for a review.
Sorry, first-degree felony, I'm thinking about people, you know, murder, for example. A victim's family do this?
Yeah, I mean, usually they don't decline to file murder cases, I can't think of any, like, so all the cases that have been brought to the attorney general's office so far, they've all been sex assault cases. So it's a bit of a wide net. I mean, I guess they're like aggravated robbery, aggravated burglary. Those are also first-degree felonies, but those seem to be prosecuted more frequently than sex assault cases.
Right. And there are examples. I mean, I guess I'm wondering why local prosecutors, especially in these four cases, denied pressing charges in the first place or denied pursuing these cases.
Well, each case is pretty unique and they all kind of had their own challenges. I mean, there was one where the woman said that she was raped by the police chief in Provo, and that had a lot of issues with like text messages between them and like, why would you keep contacting a person if you say that they did this? And, you know, so consent was questions about the lack of consent was an issue. There was one woman who said she was assaulted by her massage therapist, and she said the prosecutor asked her questions like, why would you be naked on a table? And, you know, just like, so there's just questions about consent. Why would you do this? Why, you know, maybe the evidence isn't there.
And these women, they brought their, you don't have to go through each and every one of them, but they brought their cases. They asked the Utah Supreme Court to reevaluate or to evaluate this before this new law was created. Is that correct?
Right, exactly. Yeah, they took kind of this unprecedented step. They went to the Utah Supreme Court and they said, hey, you know, and with these women, all their cases were with the Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office. And they said, the DA's office here in Salt Lake County isn't prosecuting my cases. Like, we want a special prosecutor to take on our cases. So they started with the Supreme Court, and then lawmakers passed this bill that allowed for this other point of review.
Did that solve the Supreme Court appeal? I mean, did the Supreme Court?
Yes. Okay. So they asked for their petition with the Supreme Court to be withdrawn. So they took that back and then said, we're going to go to the AG's office. The AG's office thought at the time, like, oh, we can handle this, you know, four cases or whatever. And they got funding for a part-time investigator and a part-time prosecutor. And it turns out that's not enough resources for these kind of cases.
I'm shaking my head. I mean, it was $170,000 for cases that already were deemed too, you know, complicated in one way or another, or too,
right,
like, very difficult. Doesn't seem like enough money. I mean, if this allows any victims of first-degree felonies to petition the Attorney General's office, that could be a lot more than just four people. Why just $170,000 from the legislature for this?
Well, I think the Attorney General's office thought that would be enough. They ran into a lot of challenges. I mean, one, hiring someone who wants to work part-time as a prosecutor who's qualified to handle these type of cases was very difficult. I think they didn't even end up hiring anyone, I don't think. And then, you know, going to the Craig Barlow, who works at the Attorney General's office, kind of explained, you know, we went to the police departments and said, give me all your records. And then they gave them, like, redacted records. And they're like, we don't want these redacted records. We need, like, the real deal. And so then they had to go back and struggle with the police departments. And then they go to the prosecutor's offices and the prosecutors say, well, we don't have any files at all. We never did a formal review. Mm-hmm. And so it's turning out to be really time consuming and much more expensive than they thought, even with these four women. And then on top of that, they had like four or five more. So they're seeing a lot more cases than they had anticipated.
So what comes next? I mean, is there going to be a change, a fix to this law, additional funding allocated? How does this get solved?
So they're going to go back, the AG's office, along with some of these attorneys that represent victims, and just lobby the legislature for more money. They think they need one, if not two, more prosecutors. Same for investigators. The cases right now have been pretty concentrated along the Wasatch Front. But, you know, what if you have a case out in Grant County or, you know, down in southern Utah, and how do you have one prosecutor, you know, handling the entire state? So they think they're going to need more people.
There's something, interestingly, it's kind of implicit here, is the idea that the Attorney General's office of, say, Salt Lake County in this instance, I mean, the Salt Lake County District Attorney, erred in not taking up these cases. I mean, that's the argument that the victims are making.
Mm-hmm.
And the law, I mean, the law that the state created is in a way sort of saying, yeah, we're giving space for that being the case, or for there being an error having happened there. Maybe this is a question for...
Seems like an opinion question.
Seems like a columnist question. George Pyle, do you see it that way? I mean, the fact that the state is like, well, you know, we should have another avenue to pursue these kinds of crimes.
Sure. No, I mean, so much of the criminal justice system and the legal system is set up that whatever happens can be appealed. So you can take it to somebody else and have a fresh look. And whether a prosecutor takes a case is kind of the exception to that. And you have prosecutors talking about, you know, prosecutors really have an awful lot of power as to about whether they bring a case, don't bring a case, plead down or not, and all these kinds of things that they do. And you have people who, you know, you think might have a better mindset for a defense attorney running to be a prosecutor because they see the whole picture of that and they really want to do justice and not just arrest people. So just the general idea that a local prosecutor is not always the final word, that there's somebody else who can review this case, because local prosecutors are underpaid and overworked. Local prosecutors are friends with people. Local prosecutors may or may not be enlightened enough to think that, you know, date rape is okay or not okay. And so to have that level of review, I think just on the face of it, is a good idea. But at the same time, I mean, these are difficult cases. And even if society as a whole completely accepts that certain sexual activity forced on a woman is not okay, that it's not boys being boys, that it's wrong, that it's illegal, even if you completely accept that, gathering the evidence, getting the witnesses, and especially when there are only two people involved, only two people know what happened, and consent becomes the big issue after the fact, those are very difficult cases.
And that's, I mean, I guess that's why the district attorney's office probably declined, is because they knew that it would be difficult to pursue this and get a win. Is that part of it, Jessica?
It's a little more nuanced than that. But yeah, basically, I mean, they kind of take their prosecutor duty as, if I don't have a likelihood of conviction at trial, you can't bring that case forward. I mean, some people could argue bring every case forward, and that would just be a huge burden on, you know, a justice system that's already very overburdened, and it's unfair to those defendants. I mean, there does need to be some sort of screening process. But yeah, these victims are saying, you know, we just want another review process available to us.
Other than the funding that they might add at the, you know, from this next legislative session to address the funding shortfall, mm-hmm. are there other changes that they're looking at for this law?
I don't think so. Not right now. I mean, I think it'll be so within the next like month. They said they'll make the decision on these first four cases. So I guess we'll see, you know, kind of how that process works. We haven't really seen the results of these reviews, you know, whether they take some, whether they take all. It kind of remains to be seen, you know, whether this law works in the way that these victims and these victims' rights advocates want it to.
Is there anything else that we should know on this story before we move on to a break? And actually, I'll give you the opportunity. I didn't ask you that same question on the lewdness story. Are we missing anything from that story that we should have included?
No, I think we're good on both.
Okay. Okay. All right. That's Jessica Miller. She's a justice reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune. We're going to take a quick break. Again, a reminder that you can join us by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's David Noyce, Jessica Miller, and George Pyle. It's our Friday morning news roundup. Again, we invite you to join us with your questions and comments. The number to call, 801-355-8255, or you can tweet to us at KCPW, especially if you have comments about ATVs in national parks, which we're going to right now. And David Noyce, this is a decision by the acting regional director of the National Park Service, which means that Utah will be the only state in the union to have ATVs in national parks. Is that the gist of it?
Come November 1st, if this all goes through as the directive outlines, yeah, an acting supervisor. There are a lot of acting people right now in the federal government. This acting director has told the national parks in Utah that ATVs will be allowed any place cars or trucks or other vehicles are allowed if they're street worthy. They will be able to go on those in Utah's national parks, not just the Mighty Five, but any place the national parks have jurisdictions, such as Dinosaur National Monument, Glen Canyon. National parks have jurisdiction over that also. So yeah, if this directive goes through, as said, it will be the only place. Yeah.
I'm going to quickly put in a comment. A listener called in and left this comment. This is Tom, who said, ATVs are much louder than other vehicles, and having them roar down the canyons is going to degrade everyone's experience. ATVs are made to go off-road. Even if 99% of them obey the law, that 1% is going to cause damage our grandkids can admire. I'm outraged. The rule is, you know, stipulating that you're supposed to ride just on roads, correct?
Yes. But Tom has hit on what all the concerns are, or at least many of the concerns. It was Tom, right?
Yeah.
Those concerns are. There's a reason they're called off-road vehicles. I mean, you have them, or, you know, at least vernacularly called off-road, is because the temptation is very strong to go off-road. So that will happen. Yes, especially UTVs, which have emerged as the more popular thing right now, are even louder. And, of course, people go to national parks, hopefully, you know, I mean, hopefully I think most of them to try to escape some of that. And not only that, the national parks are already dealing with congestion. Just imagine more vehicles on the roads. That's already a problem in national parks. So you can see some inherent problems. I'm not trying to say one way or the other way it should be. It's just that there are inherent problems here.
This has to do with a state law in Utah. I mean, the reason that it's happening just in Utah is to align with this state law. Can you tell us about
that? Right. Utah lawmakers passed a law in 2008. It's been updated since then a couple of times that basically said, and a lot of the rural lawmakers back this, saying any ATV, off-road vehicle that is street-worthy, in those days passed inspections and did all the different things you're supposed to have to be, say, have safety features and things like that, could go anywhere another vehicle went. This has already started to clog up roads in Moab, for instance, and they're one of the leading forces against this kind of move. So that's why it's happening, and that's why it's only going to affect Utah. Of course, the fear is that other states may get on board and it would spread nationwide.
I mean, normally when you have changes to national park policy, isn't there a public comment period? Isn't there, you know, a chance for the public to weigh in and say yes or no? And I mean, this seems like a big change in policy.
And virtually every time, I think we would say, yes, and if there is going to be this public comment period of blah, blah, blah. But this one does not spell out any kind of public comment. So they're planning on doing this, at least right now, without taking any public input. It would just take place on November 1st. And that is where a lot of advocates say this directive might be really vulnerable, especially if a lawsuit is sought or filed.
Do we know if that's going to happen? Someone filing a lawsuit?
The groups that we've talked to have said they're all looking at it. So I think a lot of people are betting that they might try to seek a temporary restraining order, at least to keep this from happening, and then try to make their case as to why it shouldn't happen.
There's an agency spokswoman, Vanessa Lacayo, who said that this is not, you know, people are still going to be cited if they go off the road, that basically you're just allowing them to drive around on the same roads that cars would be driving around on. I don't know. Will that affect how the court looks at it? You can't speculate on that, Dave. I won't ask you to do it. The opposite. Go ahead.
She said that, yes. Yeah. And of course, in a perfect world, everybody would always do exactly what they're supposed to do. But I think, as Tom pointed out, like a lot of people think that's probably not going to happen, and certainly aren't going to be officers always there to cite people as soon as it happens. And also, in national parks, once damage is done, damage can be done and it'd be hard to remediate. And like I said, traffic already is pretty, you know, Zion Canyon has already had to change with shuttles and things like that to try to more in a more purposeful way and helpful way move people through the park. So this could be really hard in places, especially like Arches and Canyonlands.
Yeah, the vice president of government affairs for the National Parks Conservation Association called it a management nightmare. And said that that permanent damage would be done. George Pyle, columnist, editorial page editor, opinion maker. What do you think about this?
This is really, really dumb. And the fact that you have to have, you know, a professional pundit tell you that is probably sad. And only in Utah. The desire that some people have to keep playing with their expensive toys and be allowed to do it anywhere they want, whether it's, you know, belching smoke on the highway or running ATVs through places where there are Native American sites or on a national park where you like to think you go for quiet, but as we say, there are so many cars there, it's kind of, you have to park the car, find a place to park the car, and then walkaways before you can find what Teddy Roosevelt wanted to leave us. As even if they say no, you can only drive it on the roads, they're built to not drive on roads. So why bother to bring it in there if you're only going to drive on the road? Of course, they're going to get off the road because they think it's their right.
I was just going to weigh in on the idea that, you know, the parks are crowded. They are crowded in the public spaces, but of course that public space is just one part of the park, and then there's a lot more conservation happening around those visited areas.
Well, right. And so, I mean, kind of the idea of a park is here's the road, here's the parking lot, here's the shuttle bus, and then the rest of it is as much as we can make it the way nature gave it to us. And if you start saying, well, except for that ATV over there that's going to run through there. And people who drive these things spend a lot of money on them. And it's like, by God, it's my right to drive my ATV anywhere I want. And it's like, grow up.
Well, are there enough? I mean, I guess are there enough places for the ATV recreator to go to, David Noyce, already in the state of Utah? That's another opinion question.
Very, very much so. I think I can say that's probably true. Of course, without having to even offer an opinion.
Okay.
This would affect 500 miles. We did some research. 500 miles of unpaved roads where cars are allowed right now in national park sites, and more than 200 miles of paved roads, and to allude to the management nightmare you referred to, Roger. Dinosaur National Monument goes in two states. So the ATVs under this rule would have to stop at the Colorado state line. It's hard to see how that would happen if this goes through.
A big line in the dirt.
Exactly, yes. Pull over, and you can't pull over because it's off-road. So,
hey, I'm going to turn to another story just in the final couple of minutes that we have here, Dave, and it's one that came from your desk as well. A decision made by a federal judge having to do with appeals to the downsizing of two national monuments. What happened there?
A federal judge that has the case about the downsizing of the Bears Ears National Monument and Grand Staircase National Monument rejected the Trump administration's request in both cases to dismiss the lawsuits. There's three lawsuits been combined into one on Bears Ears and two lawsuits combined into one on Grand Staircase. Now, this does not mean that these cases are going to are ultimately going to go to trial, but it does mean that right now, from the get-go at least, the judge is saying, no, I want to still hear more briefs on this. I want to hear more arguments. These cases are going to go forward. And there's a status hearing set for this next week.
And this is about that downsizing, and so conceivably, you know, that all hangs in the balance. Meanwhile, of course, the federal government has released new plans for these national monuments, new management plans.
For both. Not only for the parts that are still in national monument status, but also the parts now that have been removed. And, of course, a lot of people are very upset about those management plans because they've opened the door to more grazing in certain areas that it wasn't, obviously energy development, off-road things. It's created, obviously, more issues with those management plans. But right now, they are going forward.
It'll be interesting to see how those court cases play out. At this point in the show, we need to turn to our final segment, which is the underplayed stories of the week, or maybe an In Case You Missed It story. And since we haven't heard from her in a little while, let's turn to Jessica Miller, reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. What's your pick for underplayed story?
I'm picking a story that I haven't even written yet. But in about an hour, the Salt Lake Tribune will be at the Utah Supreme Court doing arguments about whether Brigham Young University's police department should be subject to the state's open record laws. The law was clarified earlier this year. So currently they are subject to those records laws. But the question of previous May 2019 is still kind of up in the air. So our lawyers will be arguing, BYU lawyers will be arguing, and I'll have a story later today kind of rehashing all of that.
And there is a whole background to the story too, but I think we're going to have to
say not that. Time for that.
Okay. All right. Jessica Miller's pick. Check it out in a couple hours' time.
Yes.
Okay. At sltrib.com. Let's turn to George Pyle for his pick for underplayed story of the week.
A couple people from Rocky Mountain Power were in to see the editorial board earlier this week, and they told us all about how they're going to start retiring coal units, which in many cases they had planned to do, but they will do it sooner. The details and the numbers are on sltrib.com. The main takeaway from this is that coal is going away, maybe not as fast as we would have liked, and largely not due to government regulation, although that's a factor, largely due to the marketplace. Renewables are getting cheaper, storage is getting better, and coal is hard. Coal plants are expensive to run. Rocky Mountain Power sees the future to some degree, and they're moving in the right direction.
All right, George Pyle's pick for underplayed story of the week. David Noyce, your pick.
Envision Utah had a committee that looked at a problem in Utah, an increasing problem of teacher exodus. Teachers either not going into the profession or once getting into the profession, getting out really quick. The biggest problem, of course, there's other issues, respect and things like that, but is pay. And we've seen salary wars going on between the districts. Right now, the highest paid district is in Park City, $50,700.
That's a starting wage?
That's a starting wage. And the committee came back with a recommendation that this is the minimum that needs to be hit, $60,000.
$60,000
as a starting wage, with figures for experienced teachers reaching up to six figures, educators being paid, some would argue, what they're worth. And it can all be done for the cheap price of $530 million, and that might be the problem.
Well, was there any recommendation on where that money might come from Envision Utah?
Ultimately, taxpayers. Now, whether the state legislators already said that, I'm not sure we can come up with that much more money every year. Districts, you're welcome to try to get that, but it would amount to hefty tax increases, or either that or a vast reshaping of how they allocate education dollars.
Okay, a story about teacher pay from managing editor Dave Noyce. I am going to go with all this week I've been reporting on this emergency rule, or the past couple of days anyways, where tobacco specialty shops are going to have to stop selling certain kinds of vaping products and put up signs about vaping products that have THC. That was going to go into effect on Monday. That's actually now going to be delayed until the 21st of October to give retailers like grocery stores and convenience stores time to comply with the rules. You can check out that story and everything else that we've been talking about on the program at sltrib.com. And I want to thank Jessica Miller, David Noyce, and George Pyle, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, for joining us on Behind the Headlines this morning. Thanks.
Thank you.
Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of this show and all of KCPW's local programs at kcpw.org. Thanks very much to our producer, Tim Pierce, for his work on the show today and to the team at Utah Public Radio in Logan. I'm Roger McDonough. Hope you have a great weekend, and we'll see you again next week.